If only they knew, the hub for young business minds.
Yes, people, it's Ted Lawler, aka Mr. IOTK from If Only They Knew, the UK's number one podcast for young business minds. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at IOTK Podcast to stay in the loop. Today, we're joined by Nick Hewitt, founder of Westlakes Hemp, Cumbria's first CBD company, who speaks to us about battling mental health issues such as bipolar, losing everything in Storm Desmond, and reveals how CBD helped her to bounce back. So if you're looking to find out how to bounce back from anything in life, or simply want to understand more about CBD, this is the podcast for you.
So I am Nick Hewitt, and I am the director of Westlakes Hemp, formerly Lakeland CBD, which is Cumbria's first cannabis company.
Perfect. And I always say, to understand who someone truly is today, it's always good to rewind the clocks a bit and sort of get a feel for what there was like in their younger days. So for you, what was you interested in? Because am I right in saying you got involved in this business world sort of unplanned, I guess? It was quite a random thing. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, totally random. Yeah. I was diagnosed. Well, I said diagnosed. When I was about 15, It was quite evident that there was something not quite right. Yeah. And it took me sort of 6 years to get a diagnosis, but essentially I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder type 2 and borderline personality disorder. That was when I was 21, 22. I mean, I'm 34 now, so it's a little while ago.
Yeah.
But it's something that I've always battled with, I've always fought with. And in 2015, where I am in Cumbria near Carlisle, there was a storm, Storm Desmond.
Yeah.
And my house was flooded. I was rescued by a lifeboat. I was zipped out the skylight in my Star Wars pyjamas, which ITV managed to get on camera, which I'm really proud of. Yeah. So got me shifting my fat ass through the window into the boat. And after that, So I hit rock bottom. And my best friend, when we were in school, my friend Nina, her dad is a psychotherapist, but he trained in this country, but they actually live in America now. And because of the way bipolar works, I was kind of up all night, asleep for most of the day, and my clock had like shifted. So her dad was online during the middle of the night when I wasn't. He sent me a message one day and just said, Nick, what is going on? Why are you always online at this time of day? So I explained to him, and he was like, right, so you've lost your head a bit then. I was like, Rick, I have lost my head completely. Yeah. And I said, if I was one of your patients, what would you suggest? And he said to me, well, I'd be prescribing you medicinal cannabis by now. Wow. Well, obviously, we don't get it in this country. It wasn't legal at all. It's not even legal now. So he suggested that I sort of try and look and see if there was any alternatives. And that's when I came across CBD. Because it was only really made legal in 2016. Mm. So from there, I started, I sort of sought it. I did a bit of research on it. There wasn't really much there. There wasn't really anyone to speak to about it. So I met some guy on a Facebook group, didn't know who he was, didn't know anything about him, ordered something from him, sent him a bank transfer with my fingers crossed. A couple of days later, this little bottle of oil turned up. Oh, yeah, like little bottle like that.
Yeah.
Little bottle like that turned up. And I started taking it. And from then, I went from being homeless, depressed, couldn't get out of bed. I was on suicide watch in my mum and dad's house. And I, sort of 3-4 weeks later, I decided that I wanted to start a business in it because of the impact that it had on me. And as I said, I'd gone from homeless with no prospects. I'd lost my job to thinking, do you know what? No, I was up. I was out and about. I was doing stuff. I was trying to reclaim my life, build my bridges back. And totally by accident. And it was literally, I gave, before I did this, I was a youth worker and a probation officer.
Yeah.
Where I was working at the time as a youth worker, that had been flooded. So we'd lost our jobs in there because it physically couldn't open. So I was at a complete loose end. Like I'd lost my home, I'd lost my partner, I'd lost everything. And CBD really, as I always say, it gave me my life back in more ways than one. It's something that I felt so strongly about. I was willing to put myself out there and leave all the jobs that I'd ever known behind to start the company.
That is such a remarkable story. We will definitely dive into all of it and sort of the impact, like you said, of CBD. Like you said, it's pretty much changed your life. But rewinding it a bit, what are
what are and what were some of the practical implications of the things that you mentioned you were going through? Was it, sorry, bipolar and
borderline personality disorder?
So what were some of the practical impacts of that on your life?
I mean, it seems like I could never hold down a 9-to-5 job. I've never been able to do a 9-to-5 job, just because if I have an episode, I mean, there's a difference between, a lot of people think of bipolar as being sort of ups and your downs, which is true. I do get that. But bipolar type 2, it's not as, I don't know how to explain it. So bipolar type 1 is what you'd see in the papers. It's what you see on TV. It's what you see in films. I don't know if you're a comic fan. Harley Quinn, she's got bipolar. There's a film with Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper. I can't remember the name of it, but they're both portrayed as having bipolar. And the sort of the implications, or the physical and mental implications, it's just the mood swings, the episodes. So my episodes can go up and down. So I can go from being, as you see me now, quite sort of, I fell a bit on a level, to be honest. I'm on a bit of a level now, but normally if I was having an episode, I could be high as a kite. You'd probably think I was on drugs.
Yeah.
I'm talking really fast. I mean, I'm talking fast, but I talk really fast. I have loads of ideas. I don't get much sleep, so I maybe sleep 1 or 2 hours. My sleeping pattern and my life pattern, so where does a lot of people can work 9-to-5, sometimes I won't go to bed till 7 o'clock in the morning. I've got a head full of bees. Very impulsive, spending money that I haven't got on ridiculous things, but I sort of hone in on them and I've got to have them. And I do it even now for West Lakes. I do it now, I sort of season it and be like, I need to have one, and essentially it could be something to leave a paper clip.
Yeah, but you just feel that real impulse.
Yeah, it's like my life can't carry on unless I've got one of those in my life.
Wow, yeah.
So that's bipolar. And then borderline personality disorder is a bit of a weird one, because if you Google borderline personality disorder, it's literally a list of why I'm a bad person.
Mm.
So people with borderline were known for being really manipulative. We can mould ourselves and change ourselves into what we need to be at the time. If you put me in a room full of hippies, I'll become a hippie. If you put me in a room full of goths, I'll become a goth. If you put me in a room full of lawyers, I can become a lawyer. It's very, you know, we're known as like mental health chameleons. We can chop and change. But the thing with the disorder is that it's not permanent. So whereas bipolar is chemical, I'll never get rid of it. I'll always have it. I'll always be up and down. It'll never change because it's a chemical imbalance in my brain. Borderline personality disorder comes from like a childhood trauma. Right. But even that, I mean, I don't mind sharing. My childhood trauma was my grandma and my granddad died within 4 or 5 days of each other when I was about 5. And from then, I never really learned how to deal with death. I didn't really learn how to deal with grief and loss. And that was my childhood trauma, because a lot of people say, oh, childhood trauma, it must be sexual abuse, it must be violence in the home. I had a great childhood. My mum and dad are awesome. Like, I've still got a really good relationship with them now. I always have done. It wasn't anything as severe as that, but it can trigger this disorder. But as you learn about it, and if you're like me, I go to psychotherapy, I've done a lot of counselling, and you can learn to manage it. So if you were to Google borderline, you see it's a list of all these bad things. If we, as people who have got it, can understand it, we can change. And things like, I did a trauma timeline recently, going through all the traumas that I've had in my life, going right back to when I was 5 and my grandma and granddad died. And I've sort of worked my way through it. So now I'm in a better position to learn how to deal with loss and learn how to deal with grief.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's kind of undoing the trauma that's happened before. So my borderline, it's not as prevalent as it used to be. It's still there, it'll always be there, and it'll always have an effect on my life, but it's not as permanent as bipolar.
I'm glad you mentioned that as well, about the trauma, and sort of you made the you distinguish between sort of what people typically think when you say childhood trauma. They think of something more physical, and sort of more direct, but it's good to know that for everyone listening that may be going through something, it's good to know that it can sort of just be something that we almost all go through, but you just had it where it was sort of very intense for a short period of time in terms of two people sort of passing it at once. So a lot of people that maybe have gone through that are thinking, well, I can't possibly claim to have childhood trauma because I wasn't physically abused or anything like that. So I think it's good to know that does class as trauma still.
Yeah, I mean, even my trauma timeline that I did recently, I've been through sort of 5 years of domestic abuse, mm-hmm. and I've been doing domestic violence sort of. It's not counselling sessions. It's like group work. So we did like 12 weeks, four lots of 12 weeks. It's been like a 2 year course that I've done. And the end result of that is that the end thing that you do is your trauma timeline. And even then, the reason my borderline really sort of is up and down is because I've had, whereas when I was five, that happened with my grandma and granddad. There's things that have happened after that that have triggered it off as well. Right. So things like my best friend died when I was 19 from cancer. That happens to people in the world. That happens to everybody. I'm pretty sure everybody in the world knows someone that's died of cancer. Even that is classed as a trauma. It doesn't have to be something huge or sexual or physical violence, or like you say, it literally can be anything. And it can be things like someone's died. That is all it can take. That's all it can take. And if you're not sort of equipped to deal with what comes with that, and for me, you know, borderline is innately dealing with grief, loss, abandonment is another one. And what we do as borderlines is we don't know the difference between death and abandonment.
Yeah.
So if I'm in a relationship with somebody and they decide that they don't want to be with me anymore, they might as well have died. The way that I will respond physically and mentally, it's as if they've died. Because mm-hmm. And that is something that, again, it goes back to this grief, abandonment and loss, all involved in one. And it could be something as simple as somebody's left you or your relationship's broken down. It doesn't have to be something huge. And that's something that I've only recently learned. When people were saying about, oh, well, this childhood trauma that you're talking about, it must be, you know. Then they look at my mum and dad and like, oh, what are we missing here? She still has a brilliant relationship with them. It was nothing to do with my parents.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with them. And just simply two people who were. And the thing is as well, my grandma and granddad, they were my favourite people in the world. You know, they were the ones that I would sit and play post offices with. And we would go and dance in the garden and we would play football. And, you know, I had a great relationship with both my grandma and granddad. And even at that young age, the world had taken my two most favourite people away from me. And as a five-year-old, how do you explain to a five-year-old that they died? All I could see is that they'd been taken away from me. What was I going to do? Because I didn't have my grandma and granddad anymore. Mm. It never even occurred to me that my dad had lost his dad or that my mum had lost her mum.
Yeah.
It was what had happened to me. And because when you're five, that's just how you think. You can't think wider than this little tunnel that you've got.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, you mentioned as well, obviously, like you've done the timeline therapy. So you've sort of gone back and you've been able to retrospectively go back and start rewiring, changing, or sort of at least looking at what happened so you can sort of understand it now. But have you got any tips or anything you've picked up for those that may have been or are going through trauma, or sort of preparing people so when the inevitable does happen and they do lose somebody they love, do you have any advice for them to sort of at least keep them a little bit stronger than they may have been without sort of the advice you may give now?
I think for anything, don't underestimate it.
Mm.
Don't underestimate the impact that a trauma like that can have on you.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I found is, you know, things like, I'm 34 now, my best friend died when I was 19. It still hurts now. And I don't think it's ever not going to hurt. But fundamentally, when someone dies, yes, it's a part of life. And we as humans have got to understand that unless I'm not religious. If you are, you know, that's entirely your prerogative. From my point of view, when someone dies, the chances are I'm never going to see them again. And that is massive. It is huge. Mm. So for me, it's spend your life and live your life and make the most of the time that you've got. Because if you do that, fully intend to make the most of it. If you do that, when you do lose someone, as much as it'll hurt and as much as it'll be a trauma for you, you can always say you made the most of the time with them.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, because that's something literally is weird, because today I was thinking that I've got two dogs and they're only like two, but like it just crossed my mind. I was like, oh my God, one day like I'm obviously going to hopefully outlive them. Because obviously dogs don't sort of have a massive lifespan compared to humans. But even I thought, oh my God, like at one point, these aren't going to be here anymore. But like you said, it's about changing that perspective and saying, okay, they're not going to be here. We can't change that fact. That's a fact. But you can change the way you deal with it. So for me, I thought, when that thought came into my mind, I was like, right, I'm going to go get them a biscuit. And I sort of, I spent an hour today playing around with them. And like you said, it's just sort of enjoying it whilst it lasts, because you can't change anything else other than how you deal with it, isn't it?
No, because I think that there's that death is inevitable. And like you said, I've got a little dog, she's only one, and the thoughts cross my mind as well.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, death, it is inevitable. And I think one of the biggest mistakes, if you like, but it's not a mistake, I just didn't know any better as a kid. Losing my grandparents at 5, losing my best friend when I was 19, I kind of just stopped thinking about death and just pretended that it didn't happen. Yeah. And if you do that, I think that's why when I've lost anybody further down the line, whether it's been through a relationship breakup, whether it's been through death, it's always come as a massive shock. So I think for me, do think about it. Do think about death, talk about it, because it's inevitable, it is going to happen. And I think, you know, the preparation that you just, like, I recently had a conversation with my dad about what was going to happen when him and my mum aren't here anymore. Well, that blew my mind. Wow. Because, yeah, again, it's one of those things. You don't want to think about it. You don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
But it's made me, it sort of gives me more oomph to sort of say, no, I am going to make the most of the time that I've got with everybody in my life, including my little dog.
Yeah.
And I think if you accept it, that death is inevitable, you can live your life in such a way that you're not going to have any regrets. Because I could easily sit here and say, oh, well, if somebody dies, you know, give yourself time to grieve. There's seven sectors of processing grief, and you'll swap between the two of them, and then there's the denial. Bollocks to all of that. That is going to happen. You can't stop it. When somebody dies, it's always going to be traumatic for you. It's always going to be painful. But rather than focus on that, focus on what you can do about it. And what you can do about it is make the most of the time that you've got. That's the way I look at it.
No, I love that. And there's a quote by Jordan Peterson. He's a lecturer in America/Canada. And one of the things he said is, go to the dragon's lair before it comes to your village, i.e. sort of like you said, deal with the problem before you sort of bury it under the carpet. And then a few weeks, a few months, even a few years later, you look and you think, oh my God, there's a massive dragon now under that carpet. Now I've got to deal with it. And now it's become too big to handle. So I think that's an amazing point. But I wanted to speak, because you mentioned, obviously, you're not religious. And I know this isn't probably what you had planned for this podcast, because we will get onto the business and stuff and the CBD in just a moment.
You don't worry.
This will be the last thing on this. But yeah, in terms of, like, you said you're not religious, but in terms of spirituality, it's something I've been getting into lately. And you said you was a youth worker, probation officer, is that right?
I used to be, yeah.
Yeah, you used to be. So do you think then that you almost have a role in this world as sort of a helper, a guider, whatever you want to see? Have you ever thought of that at all? Because it seems like what you was doing and what you're doing now in pushing CBD, and I know you're doing a lot of work for, like, legal matters for CBD. Do you see yourself as having a role, or at least a responsibility, in life as a whole?
I think so. Spirituality and what, like, the big question is what am I here for? Fundamentally, why am I on this planet? And I think the link between all of my career choices has always been, I've wanted to help people. I walked into probation wanting to help people, and I was sorely misguided. And when I got there, it was all about the paperwork and bureaucracy and not about helping people. And that's one of the reasons why I walked away from it, I'll be honest. As a youth worker, I always found, again, I wanted to be a youth worker to help people like me. When I was 15, 16 and my bipolar started showing, I had no one to turn to, I had no one to talk to. I had this one youth worker who helped me through a lot, and I had this one teacher, my English teacher, she was really helpful with it. And I thought, I want to do that for somebody else. So was I put on this earth to help people? I'd like to think so. I'd like to think so. Whether that's spiritual or not, I don't know. But I feel like I'm very much aware that I think I'm an empath,
which
I think it kind of goes with the helping people. I seem to be able to sort of feel what other people are feeling without them having to tell me. Like, people have almost said I've been really perceptive. And again, I don't think it's anything to do with religion. I think it's just about us as people and how we connect to other people. And it's something that I think, as I've got closer to my 40s, I do think about it a lot. Because I don't, do I think there's a man in the sky that's going to resolve us all of our sins? No, I don't. Is there something that connects us all? Is the universe bigger than what we think it is? Absolutely. And I think we'd be silly to think otherwise. Like, so, we're just a small part of the universe. It's huge. And I've seen, you know, things, I'll tell you what I've been looking into recently, DMT trips. There's one for you. Something I bet you didn't think you'd be talking about on the podcast today. But I've been looking at DMT trips. Yeah. And, you know, when I was going through all this thing about death and loss and grief, a couple of my friends had experienced DMT before, and I'd said to them openly, are you, because DMT, do you know much about it? Do you know?
Yeah, I know quite a bit. Yeah.
You do? So it's a chemical that's released when you die. Mm-hmm. So for me, as someone with borderline who's innately scared of death and fear and abandonment and loss, and I can't deal with it, I found it really interesting. Mm-hmm. And anyone that I've spoken to that's tried DMT has openly said to me that they're not scared of death anymore, because they realise that we're all linked and we just float back into the universe. And said to me, it's really difficult to explain it to you without you actually experiencing it. So it's something that I'll be honest, I want to do it. I want to try it for myself because I think it'll help massively with what I'm going through. But listening to them and listening to how people have experienced these DMT trips, at the end of the day, human bodies are made for a purpose and they've been made in such a way, it's so intrinsic. Everything's got a job. Everything in your human body has got a job, which is why, you know, CBD, we've got an endocannabinoid system that CBD triggers. It's there for a reason. Yeah. So to me, DMT is released just before you die. Why? Why is it? Why does it do that? Why is it there? There must be a reason for it. So to me, that in terms of spirituality, that's the road that I've been heading on for a while. And again, I'm sort of trying with different ideas, but the thought, yeah, it is there. It is there.
We will get onto some of that as well, and especially like the internal system that you mentioned. I think that's really important to know, because a lot of people don't know about it. But in terms of sort of, you said the path you was going down, and obviously Storm Desmond, you mentioned it earlier, but what happened there? And looking back now, do you think that was sort of the thing that was the, like the trigger to get you on that path and sort of get you where you're going now? Because a lot of things that have happened to me seems like it's all led down one road. So do you think the thing that happened with Storm Desmond and everything you went through, as bad as it was, do you think ultimately it was for a reason to go down this path today?
I think so. Because it seems to, I mean, if you look at Storm Desmond, you know, it was a massive event for the area. The whole of the city was flooded. I know it wasn't just Carlisle. And it's not something that, you know, with the city itself didn't recover easily from it. I never recovered from it. And it was a really, really hard experience to go through, in the way that I literally lost everything. I lost my home, I lost my belongings, I lost my job. I had nothing left. I had absolutely nothing left. And pun intended, it was sink or swim time for me. You know, it was kind of right, you've wiped the slate clean, you've absolutely nothing left. You've got to start somewhere. And I think the reason, is it a reason? Maybe not a reason, but if I think about all the things that have happened in my life, what you would call these little triggers that have set me off down different paths, everything has led to where I am now. And I don't think I could, when I look at all the different jobs that I've had, the relationships that I've had with people, for instance, when I was 16, I worked in a pharmacy. And I worked with them on and off for over a good 15 years. I'm still friends with them now. So there's my knowledge of pharmaceuticals and drugs. Yeah. Then I went on to probation. I learned all the legal jargon, the policy. I then went on to working with, the gangs in Liverpool, Manchester, working with kids. You know, there was doing a lot of drug and alcohol workshops. I was your Tampax woman that went to school to talk about Tampax and periods. Wow. You know, so... Yeah. Yeah. So, do you see what I mean? So when you think about the job that I've got now, it's very much, it is all legal based. I've got to know laws inside and out. I've got to have a knowledge of pharmaceuticals, otherwise I wouldn't be able to give very good advice. And even when it comes to CBD, I mean, the fact that I was up that morning that I was talking to my friend's dad, was it a coincidence that we were both up at that time of day on Facebook Messenger chatting about how I was feeling? Like, there's too many things that have happened to say that it wasn't, you know, there's too many coincidences. There's too many coincidences.
I always say as well, like it, from my own perspective, there's no such thing as coincidences, just synchronicities. Because when, like you said, when you look back and you add them all together, you almost couldn't make it up when you look back and join the dots. You're like, wow, it's sort of almost perfect in a sense to put you in the most perfect position that you could possibly be in for now, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's honestly, that's truly hand on heart how I feel, because if all the little paths that I've gone down, if I hadn't done any of them, I wouldn't be in the position I am now to speak my opinion and tell the truth about CBD, and you know, and it's not, and believe it or not, CBD and cannabis, even cannabis when I was in school, I was never a cannabis user.
Yeah.
It's not something I was interested in. I was never a typical stoner, if that's what you want to call it, but it's something that kind of just crept up on me. And I think I had to go through what, if I'd started smoking weed at 14, 15, 16, I'd probably have a very different view to cannabis than what I do now. And the chances are, I wouldn't have, you know, if I was a massive stoner, I couldn't be a probation officer.
That's it.
I couldn't have worked in the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. So that for me has come at a very late stage, but it could have easily been so much different, especially with mental health problems, because when you've got mental health problems at 15, 16, all you want to do is take it away.
Yeah.
And cannabis, and that, when you speak to most people of that age, why do you smoke cannabis? Oh, because it helps me. It stops me from stressing out. It chills me out. So I was a prime candidate to be a massive stoner when I was in school. And for some strange reason, I wasn't.
Yeah, like, it is strange, isn't it? Like you said, it is almost perfect. But like you said, you lost it all. How did you bounce back then? So CBD, what was the impact on you, and how has it sort of led you to where you are now? Because obviously now you've got a business sort of made entirely of CBD products and stuff like that. So how did that happen from losing everything to now being so super successful where you are at now?
I started taking it, and I'll be honest, I was really dubious about it. I was like, the little bottle that fella sent me from that Facebook group, it could have been petrol I was drinking, it could have been anything.
Yeah.
And I think because of where I was at, I mean, when I say I was suicidal, I mean, I had to move back in with my mum and dad, and I had to keep the bedroom door open, and someone was coming to check on me every half an hour. I was on suicide watch. Mm. Hand on heart, I wanted to die. I didn't want to be here anymore. And it was like last resort. I'd taken all the antidepressants in the world. I'd taken all the antipsychotics. Nothing's going to work. I had no other choice. And when my friend's dad had mentioned CBD to me, I got the bottle and I started taking it. And unfortunately, my mindset was, well, even if it kills me, it won't matter.
Yeah.
And that was a horrible place to be. It really was a horrible place to be. But I genuinely thought to myself, if it kills me, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I started taking it, and I didn't really notice anything for the first week or so. But I would say by the second week, it was just little things I started noticing, like my sleeping pattern had got a little bit better. And when I was going to sleep at night, I wasn't having nightmares. And I was sort of, my mum, she explained it to me really well. She was like, Nick, when you were lying in bed, you wouldn't get up and do anything. And she said, one day you just came down and asked me for a cup of tea. She said, it's the first time I'd seen you out of bed in 3 months.
That was the first time. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was like, I couldn't wait to get this cup of tea in your hand. Like, just because I'd come down the stairs and asked for it. And she said, all you did was get the cup of tea and you took it back upstairs. And she said, I sat down on the sofa and I was like, she's still there. There's something's got her out of bed today. So the next day, she said, I came down, asked her for a cup of tea. And instead of taking it upstairs, I sat in the chair and talked to her for half an hour. And then I went back to bed. The next day, I got up, I asked for a cup of tea. I stayed for an hour. The next day, I got up, I asked her for a cup of tea, talked to her for an hour. And then I went and got in the shower. So it was very, very gradual. And you know, it was just baby steps like that. Like, I won't talk you through every day that happened. But, you know, I got to the point where eventually I was getting up and asking her for a cup of tea. And I was getting in the car and going to my business partner's house, and we were writing business plans.
Wow. So it was just those gradual steps that eventually led you to where you are now, literally. And it just shows it is all about those small steps. Like, just do what you can do for that day or in that moment. And even if you can do, no matter what it is, even in the gym, like even I use that sort of theory, like if I'm doing push-ups, I just do a set amount of push-ups. And if I'm done and I can't do any more, then I say, all right, I'd leave it. I'll try again tomorrow. And then tomorrow I do one more. And like you said, gradually, before you know it, you're just smashing them out. So I guess that's what it's all about, isn't it? Small progress, and then eventually it all adds up over time.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I did. And within the space of like 6 months, you know, the business was open.
Yeah, wow. That's such a short space of time though, isn't it? Relatively speaking, like that's almost nothing compared to a whole lifetime.
No, and it just started off that one day. That one day, I took a couple of drops the day before, and I just got up, and that was the first step. I asked my mum for a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And from there, it just sort of exploded. So as I start, because I mean, the main reason that I got into CBD is what I saw what it did for me. You know, sort of 6 months later, I saw what it did for me. I saw how better I felt. I'd gone to my business partner with this idea, and he was like, do you know what? Out of all the mental ideas that you've had, this might just work. Yeah. And the reason behind it is because that little bottle that I was getting off that fella off that Facebook group, it could have been anything. And I can remember a couple of people said to me, Nick, should you really be taking that? But as I've said to you, I didn't care. If it killed me, I wasn't bothered. And for me, I saw what it did for me. And sort of a year later, I started talking to my mum about her taking it, because my mum broke her back in 2012. She was taking a lot of painkillers. And I, you know, said to her about it. And when she was doing her research, there was no like governing body, there was no regulatory body, there was no information online. It was all very stoner-esque. Mm-hmm. And for my mum, who wasn't really ever into cannabis in any form, for her to go onto a website and be faced with Bob Marley and dreadlocks and ganja leaves everywhere and joints everywhere, and she was just like, no, she didn't trust it.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, there's not just going to be my mum that's like that. There's got to be other people. That's probably the reason why people are so reserved on taking it, or why they're so apprehensive about it. And that was where the idea came from. I was like, well, why can't I be the one to share the information? Mm. And then when I went digging, I then found out that there wasn't just us that were wanting to do it in Cumbria. There was, I can't remember the name. There was two brothers, they were doing it in Scotland, and I found a company in Essex, an extraction plant, which is essentially where our first suppliers came from. They were extracting it on a plant in Essex, and it was really funny because it turned out the guy who was the director of that company that was doing the extraction, he was actually from my hometown in Cumbria, in Whitehaven. Now that is a massive coincidence.
Yeah, that is.
I remember for the first day I met him, Timmy's name is, the first day I met him, I walked in, he invited us down to go and have a look at the extraction plant. And I walked in the hotel and he met us in the bar. I literally just said to him, oh, hi, my name's Nick, nice to meet you. And he went, that's a Whitehaven accent. I was like, yeah. He was like, my whole family are from Whitehaven. Turns out my granddad and his granddad are best mates down the mine.
Wow, that is a
that was in Essex. And not only that, he'd lived in Thailand for the last 10 years, so it's not as if we'd been anywhere near each other.
Wow, that is insane. That is nuts. That is definitely a coincidence, if you want to call it that. But one thing you mentioned just there as well was almost like the stigma people attach to cannabis, CBD, etc. And it seems like you're doing a lot to sort of change that stigma, because if you think about it, it's quite weird that there is even a stigma, because it's a natural thing. It's like having a stigma against lettuce, in a sense. And it's the same as magic mushrooms. It's like people are like, oh my God, I'm not taking a magic mushroom. And it's like, you know, it's just a it's literally a mushroom. It comes from the ground. It comes from the same place. Like, but for whatever reason, we could talk endlessly about why that is. There is a stigma. So what do you think of that stigma, and what are you sort of doing to actively change that, if anything?
I think, if anything, I mean, the blame can go on governments and advertising in the past. You know, when I was a kid, it was drummed into us, don't do drugs, they're bad. Yeah. You know, that included cannabis. And I'll be honest, until I sort of got into the industry, I didn't really know much about it. As I said, I was never interested in it in school. It wasn't something I wanted to try. It was, and any time I did try it, it just made me ill. You know, I chucked the, up here it's known as a whitey. That, you know, that had happened to me a couple of times, and I just wasn't interested in it. It made me sick and I didn't like it. Whereas once I'd sort of got into the industry and found out more about it, as you say, it's a plant. And I think in this country, we struggle with it a lot because our government are, I don't want to go down, I don't want to say, I always do this. I don't want to sound like I'm going down the conspiracy theory nut road, but in this country, it's true. So the biggest exporter of cannabis, medical cannabis, in Europe is us. And it's a cannabis farm in Norfolk. It's owned by British Sugar. They've got 54 acres, and it's owned by a fella called, let's see if I can get it the right way around. So the CEO of British Sugar is Howard May. His wife is Theresa May, the old Prime Minister. The managing director is a guy called Paul Kenwood, and his wife is the ex-drugs policy minister, Victoria Atkins.
Wow, so they're all connected, even though they're saying, no, you can't have it. They're basically growing it.
They're making millions out of it. And the only reason the farm in Norfolk ever got found out is because local people kept phoning the police and grassing the neighbours up and saying, I can smell weed, it's coming from my neighbour's house. And it wasn't, it was coming from the farm down the road.
Wow.
They'd already been there 4 years before anybody knew anything about it. So, you know, it's that thing of, you can blame the government, because it's true. It is a conspiracy theory. They are selling medical cannabis to Canada. They're selling it to Italy. And the people in this country, we're not getting a thing from it. Victoria Atkins, the drug policy minister, she was still in her position as the drugs policy minister. And when people found out that her husband was the managing director of British Sugar, she then had to, anytime it was brought up in Westminster, when somebody wanted to talk about cannabis, you know, you can YouTube this, she'll stand up and say, I'm sorry, I can't comment because there's a conflict of interest. How can we have a drugs policy minister that can't talk about the drug, the most used drug in the whole of the country?
Yeah, insane.
And then the public got wind of it, and she was like, she wasn't sacked, she was removed from that position and sideslided into somewhere else. I don't actually know what she does now, but she's not there anymore. But even that, it's a vested interest. Like the Conservative Party, there's not just those two that are involved in it. There's more, but people are so secretive about business. You'll never know the full extent of it. But for me, that stigma comes from the government. When I say government, I mean it's filtered down through the police. So when I say to the government, you can blame the government. The government control the police. The police are very, cannabis is still a drug, we'll arrest you for it, we'll do you for it. The sentences to go with it, there's still guidelines. You know, the drugs are still scheduled. They refuse to change their stance on it. But it's not their fault, because that policy comes from government. Our government are so far behind in terms of drugs policy compared to the rest of the world, it's untrue. It is untrue. But yet, we're the biggest exporter of medical cannabis. Yeah. How is that fair? How is that right? And what always gets me, I'm in the industry, I am so angry about it. Why isn't the rest of the world fuming? Why isn't the rest of the UK absolutely raging about this? My best friend died at 19 because she had skin cancer. We know there is research all over the world to show that cannabis can help with cancer. She might still be here. It's just, to me, it's not fair. And I think the government bury it so much. They bury it under, we haven't got time to rewrite policy, we're dealing with COVID. We haven't got time to rewrite policy, we're doing this. We can't, you know, there's always an excuse. There's always a reason why it can't be discussed in Parliament. There's always a reason why it can't be discussed in Westminster. If you step out your comfort zone as an activist, they'll come down on you like a ton of bricks. Yeah. Like, there's just something not right, and it's because they're trying to monopolise the market, and it is all, and don't kid yourself, it's all because of business. It is all business for them. Because if they start letting other companies deal in medical cannabis and start dealing in CBD, and, you know, even now, the CBD companies are dealing with the novel foods license, and even that's a load of, it's just a technicality. Even all of that, it's just to stop us doing what we're doing. But I think you're finding now, especially with the pandemic, the CBD industry is so big in this country, they can't ignore it anymore.
That's the thing. Like, from what you just said there, the only word to sort of describe it, I guess, is just ridiculous, because once you look into it, the evidence is so clear. There's almost no argument against why it shouldn't be legal. Like we said before, that the reasons why it is still illegal is just, we could speak about that forever, because it's so, again, it's so obvious, but it just, you have to sort of lay it out for people to understand. But one thing I wanted to get, because we're running out of time here, one thing I wanted to get across was the the benefits of CBD. Obviously, you've mentioned the personal benefits for you, but I think this will help reduce the stigma, because you mentioned, I'll struggle to pronounce it, that it in a cannabinoid system.
Endocannabinoid system.
That's it. Can you explain that, please? Yeah. I think that will go a long way in explaining the benefits and helping reduce the stigma, because it's literally a key part of our bodily process.
Yeah. So it's the equivalent of having, you're like your immune system. You've got an immune system. Everyone's got one that fights off viruses. So the endocannabinoid system is essentially another one of those. But it repairs your body from the inside out. And the best example I can give you is from myself, really, my bipolar. So you know before when I said to you that my bipolar is it's a chemical imbalance. My body doesn't produce enough dopamine or serotonin. Bottom line, that's why I've got bipolar.
Yeah.
So what happens is when you put CBD into your body, whether it's capsules, whether it's the oil, when you orally ingest it, it kickstarts this CBD endocannabinoid system, and that sends out like feelers into all parts of your body. You've got CBD receptors in all your vital organs, your skin, your hair, your eyes, lungs, liver. It's everywhere. If everything has got CBD receptors in it. And these little receptors run around, and if they find a problem, they find the problem, they assess the problem, and they tell your brain how to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So my little receptors can see and work on my brain and think, oh, she's not producing enough serotonin, she's not producing enough dopamine, right, can we get the body to make some more? So my body then makes more serotonin, makes more dopamine, and that balances my bipolar out. So it's not that CBD does anything specific, it doesn't. All it does is it kickstarts this system in your body, and this system finds the problem and fixes it for you, or as best that it can.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say to me, well, why doesn't it work anyway? Because in 1938, cannabis in this country was banned, and that included, used to have CBD and hemp in our food chain. So the farmers would feed hemp to cattle, they'd feed hemp seeds to chickens. You can press it, you can get the oil, we used to cook with the oil. It was in our food chain. You can get it in broccoli, you can get it in some fish as well, or white oily fish.
Mm-hmm.
It should be in our food chain. And if it had been in our food chain all this time, then our endocannabinoid systems would be working. But when they banned it in 1938, you know, we're nearly 100 years on, and it's had a massive impact. There's research is coming out of California now where, you know, have you heard of like your fibromyalgia, polymyalgia,
yeah,
or your neurological disorders? And there isn't a reason for them. There isn't a reason. And, you know, there's research coming out to say that it is directly an endocannabinoid deficiency.
Wow.
This is, you know, because we're 100 years on. If you think in terms of, like, evolution, 100 years, you're now seeing the effects of what really happens when you take CBD and hemp out of our food chain. And it's your fibromyalgia, your polymyalgia, your chemical imbalances. And bipolar would be a massive one. You know, schizophrenia, they're all linked, they're all imbalances of chemicals in your body. And it's because this regulatory system, this endocannabinoid system, is built to regulate. And if this bodily function isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, then that's when you find people have got issues. I mean, the term fibromyalgia, I'd never heard of until 3 years ago. My auntie, she's got it. And to get the diagnosis of fibro, they had to rule out everything else. And when they couldn't find an answer, they just stopped, like, oh, it's fibro. And, you know, the symptoms of it, tiredness, pins and needles, pain, imbalance, like sweats, hormones, you know, mood swings, all of that. And she takes CBD for it now. And it does help. It massively helps her. But I think for us as a race, no, as a collective in the UK, we're so far along now without it that we've done irreparable damage. And our ethos as a company is, yeah, we've started selling the capsules for it to get people to take it, and it'll balance their endocannabinoid system and get them working and get people feeling better. But essentially our main goal is to get it back in our food chain. You know, our new cafe that we're opening, we're going to start selling hemp flour, hemp seed, so that people can cook with it. They'll be able to get the oils, they'll be able to put it back into the food, into their own food chain. He said it's a food supplement, just like, for me, it's the equivalent of vitamin C.
Yeah.
vitamin C is in our food chain. You can go and drink orange, you can drink lemons, and it's in your it's in your system already. But for some people who don't do that, they do have to go and get vitamin C tablets if they need a boost. For me, that's how CBD should be viewed. It is a vital component to our bodily function, to our bodily functions. And I think it's not against our human rights, but I think for a whole nation to not have access to it, you don't realise the damage that's being done. And we never will, because we weren't there in 1938 when it was banned. We won't have seen what people were like before that. So it's an interesting subject when you get into it. It's really interesting.
It really is. And I think you've done an amazing job there on sort of drawing the parallels between what people stigmatise, i.e. the cannabis, CBD, and what people sort of do on a daily basis anyway. It's just that one, for whatever reason, has been pushed down the no path, and one's been pushed down the yes path by whoever's in control. But I really appreciate that final sort of summary on the parallels, like I said, and everything you've said so far. I feel like as Cumbria's first CBD company, and probably the biggest now, which you are, I think you probably have a lot of pride in that title as it is. But I think in terms of the greater society and the mission that you're on with CBD and pushing through the laws and whatever it may be with CBD and cannabis, I think you're doing an amazing job at that as well. So final things then, what are your future plans, both for the company and sort of the work you're doing to push through CBD through society?
So for our company, we're developing more products. We're looking at starting to make our own cosmetics, sort of looking at shampoos, conditioners. We want to be able to make things in-house. Yeah. Up until now, we've been working with companies who we give them the specifications and they make it for us. But we quite like to make stuff in-house. We're hopefully opening our own CBD coffee house and community centre. Wow. Hopefully second week in June, I think, 11th of June, I think we're going for. Wow. So in terms of business and the space that we've got, we don't, you know, it's not just a cafe. It's not just, and again, a lot of it is for breaking down the stigma. It's, we want to have a nice space for people to come. You don't have to have CBD in your coffee if you don't want to. You can just come in, have a crack. You know, the whole place has been designed on wheels, so we can push all the counters back, we can push all the fridges back and everything. We can have late night gigs, acoustic gigs, comedians. We can offer the space up to community groups, young people, older people. You know, it's a community space, and that's what we want to keep it as. In terms of fighting for what we believe in, I'll never stop. I think I've been invested in the law and policy for a long time now, and my, you know, in an ideal world, the policy needs rewritten, and the only people that can do something about it are people like me, people like you, who can reach people and explain to them. Because as I said to you, I don't understand why people aren't angry about the Conservative government and the way that they treat cannabis, because nobody knows about it. It's censored, it's filtered. And I think for me, it's pushing forward, getting the word out, speaking to the right people, and making sure that people understand, and doing things like podcasts like this, where people who listen and sort of hopefully take note of what I've said and think, oh, do you know what, I'm going to go and do a bit more research. And that hopefully will have a knock-on effect.
That does sound amazing with what you're doing with the business and what you just said there as well. There's a thing, just quickly before we end, there was a thing that I saw the other day about the 100th monkey effect, which is basically where a group of monkeys, one started washing their food in the water, then the next one started doing it, and then it hit 100 monkeys in that tribe. Then all of a sudden the whole tribe started doing it, but even monkeys in other tribes in completely different locations that had no interaction started doing it as well. So just a spiritual woo-woo thing there for anyone listening. There seems to be a collective consciousness. So one by one, like you said, through the podcast, through whatever you're doing outside of this as well, just keep sort of enlightening people, enlightening yourself. And yeah, before you know it, there'll be a great awakening. Everyone will be happy. There'll be sunshine all the time. Everyone will be loving life. That's sort of my theory on it anyway, in a condensed way.
No, I totally agree on that. On the day that it happens, me and you can look at each other and be like, yeah, told you so.
Yeah, we done it. We smashed it anyway. But yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking to you and hearing your insights. I think this is really important for everyone listening as well to check CBD out and any other things like this out as well. Final question before I let you go, what do you want your legacy to be? Because it seems like you're doing powerful stuff, as I've mentioned. So yeah, what do you want your legacy to be?
She changed the world one leaf at a time.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, like I said, thank you so much. That was a perfect ending. If there's anything else you'd like to say, or you want to let people know where to find out more about yourself and the company, please let them know now.
So we're online, www.westlakeshemp, but on Facebook, Insta, Twitter, all the socials. Yeah, drop me a line. My email address is nick@westlakeshemp.co.uk. Feel free to email me if you want any more info.
Perfect. On that note, thank you so much.
If only they knew, the hub for young business minds.